And we welcome you.
Humidity
to
is
the
at 93%
WGTD.
Humidity at 93%, 78 degrees Kenosha, 79 for Racine at 10 past 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're, of course, right in the middle of summer, almost exactly midway in summer. And so it is very, very appropriate for us to spend the first minutes of today's morning show talking about all of the amazing things there are to do in Door County. And I have a feeling that is not any sort of news flash for anybody listening to this program. Either you are someone who frequently visits Door County, or you at least know of all the wonderful things there are to do there. But there are always new things to do, things that you have not actually sought out for one reason or another. I have in front of me a really wonderful and interesting book called 100 Things to Do in Door County Before You Die. And it is a book that is very nicely laid out with various categories of what people might want to do in terms of recreation or fine dining or exploring the breweries or the world of nature or more of the fine arts. There are all kinds of different things to do in Door County. And some of them are famous things that everybody pretty much knows about. But sometimes it's nice to learn a little bit more about some of these staples, some of these familiar friends, if you will. And there, very likely, there are things in Door County that you had no idea even existed. And that's part of what this book is all about. It is co-written by two women, Jean O'Brien Gibbons, and my morning show guest, Tamara Gomund, who is actually an architect. And her previous book is 100 Things to Do in Rockford Before You Die. And I know for a fact that Rockford, Illinois is a very, very interesting small city. And but she considers Door County to be something of a second home. And that is part of what puts her in a position to co-author this book, which is published by Reedy Press, again titled 100 Things to Do in Door County Before You Die. And Tamara Gomund, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Before we start talking about Door County, I just have to ask you briefly about the work that you do as an architect.
Well, it's kind of funny. I am a licensed architect, and I've worked most of my career in architecture. But in the past about 8 years or so, I sort of took a sidestep, and I am writing for an engineering firm. So I've taken my experience with architecture and my love of writing, and then sort of put those together. And I do like all our outward facing creative writing, if you will, our news stories, you know, our social media content, our website content. And it's a civil engineering firm in the Chicago area.
Excellent. You mentioned in your small biography that you consider Door County to be something of a second home. Tell us about that. I mean, and just how long a history are we talking about in terms of you being a very frequent visitor to Door County?
Yeah, so I've been a frequent visitor since before my children were born, and they're 29 and 22. So I would say I've been going up there probably about 35 years, often several times a year, sometimes just annually. But it was actually my friend, the co-author is a good friend of mine, Jean. She's been going up there her whole life, and she was the first one that suggested it to me when I just wanted a weekend getaway. And I immediately fell in love with it, and I go off. And unfortunately, I don't have a place there, but I'm starting to look for one, possibly for retirement. So, but then Jean, I've been going a lot, and I know a lot about it. And I'm a member of Ride On Door County, which is a writing organization, and I like to go have quiet time there and do writing activities, but also just go with my family and have fun. Jean, her primary residence is in Evanston, Illinois, but she's had a residence in Door County since she was a child. Her family had one for a long time, and she and her husband now have one. So she brings a little more of the true resident credentials, the cred. I bring more like I just go there all the time. So together, between the two of us, we knew a lot, but we also had different favorites. So when we collaborated, it was a very interesting collaboration.
And I'm sure that's part of what makes this book as interesting as it is. One thing that was interesting in the preface, I think that's where this is mentioned, is the fact that you envision this book as being of potential value both to the seasoned visitor to Door County like yourself, but also for somebody who's essentially a newbie, who has maybe never been there before or very infrequently. And really, you know, for them, Door County is kind of this beautiful, wonderful blank slate. It's kind of interesting to think about a book being useful to readers poles apart, like what I have just described. Was that challenging in terms of how you put this book together?
That's an interesting question. I wouldn't say that was challenging, because we really just started by just building the list to start with and saying, what do we want to include? What matters to us? You know, and we tried to include as much as possible. You probably noticed that some things have like it's a category with a list of maybe some restaurants that fit a certain category, and then some things are very specific. But I do think it is really fascinating that sometimes a book like this, sometimes if you're really familiar, like the town you live in, you live there your whole life, and you forget that there's this really cool thing to do in your town, you know? Mm. And so I think that's the neat thing, is when you are either reminded of something you've forgotten about, you know, if you've gone there forever, or you tend, in a vacation situation like in Door County, you tend to go do what your family always does, but you may never have gone and seen, you know, the big band jazz bands at, you know, the entertaining barn, you know, or something like that. And, you know, so just having a different perspective, or the idea that, oh yeah, there are other things we could do when we go up there, I think is a cool thing.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that one of the things I learned from your book is where the name Door County comes from. That is what Door County is named after. And I think a lot of people, I mean, because I think most of us think of Door County as this largely idyllic, incredibly lovely, wonderful, fun place to vacation, might be taken aback to learn what Door County is named after.
That's right. It's named after Death's Door, which was the body of water between the top of the peninsula and Washington Island. And some of that may be folklore, because it was back with Native Americans and the French. I believe there was a lot of French, I don't know, explorers or trappers or something up there, the first, you know, people. And it got a reputation as being a pretty tough place to navigate by ship. And there's a lot of shipwrecks up there. And that's where that Death's Door name came from lore through time. And that's what Door County is named after.
So named after something that is just the opposite of fun and idyllic. But of course, yes. The main point of your book is that there is an incredible array of things to do and see and experience there. For those of you just joining me, I'm spending the first minutes of today's morning show talking with Tamara Goman, who is a co-author of a new book called 100 Things to Do in Door County Before You Die. And this is a book that outlines in very nice fashion all kinds of things to do in Door County, 100 of them altogether. And as Tamara Goman just mentioned, there's actually even a little more than 100, because in some cases we're seeing a list of breweries or a list of restaurants or a list of hiking trails. And so there's even more than that in the pages of this book. It's a modestly sized book, but packed with information. Talk for a moment about the process of, first of all, assembling this list of 100 things, but also the way in which the book was organized. Did it take shape very naturally, or was there a little bit of push and pull in terms of exactly how this book should be crafted?
So the 100 Things books, there's sort of a family of books that this Reedy Press, the publisher, puts out the 100 Things books, and they work with local authors. But you have to go pitch them your idea for a place. So the format, the categories of food and drink and sports and rec and all that is prescribed from them. So then we would work within that. But then, so it really just started with Jean and I sitting down, you know, up there in her cottage, or she's got a condominium that's really nice on Green Bay, sitting at her table up there and starting a list, like, okay, let's talk about restaurants. What do we want to include? Should we categorize them somehow? What should stand alone? Why? You know, and, you know, we do some things. We take things out. We put other things in and kind of just work together till we kind of got to where we thought it was a perfect list. And that's a pretty tall order. And then we also had the stuff that we kind of knew intimately and the things that we knew we'd have to go explore and visit or research because we hadn't done them before, but we know people enjoy them, or it's something that should be included, even if we didn't personally do it. So there was that aspect. She collaborated with me, and she provided the photographs, and I did all the writing. So when it came to the writing, with each one, then what I would do is sit with it a minute, and I would try to, well, let me back up and explain that the book is intended to be written in somewhat experiential language. It's intended to be a little bit light, a little humorous in some spots. It's not meant to read like someone's marketing website. You know, it's a little more like, what's the experience of doing this? So with each of the entries, I would sit with it and think, okay, even though it's a paragraph or two, what's my story? What's my little angle on it? You know, like the Kena Island Lighthouse, you know, you can talk about the fact that it's, you know, still active and run by the Coast Guard, or how old it is, or that it's one of the most popular things to do. But to me, the story was the twisty trek up to the top on the metal filigree steps. To me, that was the story, you know, and so that's sort of what built the couple paragraphs about the Kena Island Lighthouse. Yeah. So that was the process, is taking, once we established what it was going to be, what is the story? Hmm. And it was funny because Jean then was a very good collaborative reviewer too, and sometimes she'd get to one and she'd say, that one's a little boring, let's go back and try again. And I'd have to go back to and be like, okay, what's more exciting about this particular entry? So it was a really fun process. It was really fun. It was fun to work with her on it.
It's very well written, and I compliment both of you on it. Just for the sake of our listeners, the sections of this book are food and drink, music and entertainment, sports and recreation, culture and history, and then shopping and fashion. And the book explores all of these facets of all of the things there are to do in Door County. And there is, of course, plenty of information, and yet it is a relatively modest-sized book. I forgot to... 144 pages total. So that also means that it's a book that has been created with some efficiency, and it can be explored cover to cover quite easily, and yet there is a substantial amount of information here. I wonder if one of the tricky things was figuring out the balance between some place that people are likely not acquainted with versus something like the famous restaurant Al Johnson's. That's the one where the goats are eating right on the roof, and I think just about everybody has heard of that. And you know, somebody writing a book about Door County could probably, it would be a defensible choice to not even bother with that. It's like it goes without saying, and yet you give a little bit of time to Al Johnson's restaurant and to other places that are very, very well known. What did you think about in terms of including those kind of places that are very, very familiar? What was most important to you and your co-author when it came to those kind of headliners?
Yeah, that's a good question. The headliners, as you call them, I mean, they become headliners because people enjoy them, right? Because they're popular. They don't become popular if they're terrible, you know? So Al Johnson's, a lot of families and things, when you've got little kids, don't care if they eat Swedish pancakes, but want to see the goats on the roof, right? You know? So the reason they're headliners is because they're popular. So that's a nice thing to share for that category of people that's maybe never been there. Hmm. You know, so people that have been there, yeah, they don't necessarily need to hear about Al Johnson's. But, you know, I do think, because this book is on Amazon, and I think it's a good tool if, you know, someone three states away is like, where are we going to go this summer? And they're looking for something and they look it up on Amazon. This is who this book is going to speak to, is the people, you know, that are checking it out for the first time. Or have, I find in Illinois and even in southern Wisconsin, a lot of people have heard of Door County, but they don't really know what it is. They think it's sort of like Wisconsin Dells or something. Mm. And they don't know that it's this, you know, amazing, this place that has like an amazing, unique natural element that's unique for Wisconsin and the Midwest, because it's part of the Niagara Escarpment. And, you know, they don't know that it has theater and art and culture, you know, and they don't know that it actually doesn't have water parks, that all the fun is outside in nature, you know.
Right.
So I think that's, again, but I mean, I digress from your original question. It's really just about giving a newbie the whole lay of the land, from the most popular to the obscure. So
I like that. In the preface, you remind us that somebody a long time ago dubbed Door County the Cape Cod of the Midwest. And, of course, that right there is going to, I think, create a helpful distinction between Door County and a place like the Wisconsin Dells. It's a drastic difference, and it's important to underscore that. You mentioned that this book is not just a compilation of your favorites and Gene's favorites, but important things to do in Door County, including a few things that neither of you had much in the way of direct experience with. I wonder if you could maybe tell our listeners about a couple of those places that you ended up seeking out and exploring for the purposes of writing this book and writing about them with firsthand experience versus just reading about it in a brochure.
Sure. Well, Gene visited there's a bird sanctuary, which she knew about, I did not know about, and she went and explored the bird sanctuary. And it's a really interesting place because they take, rescued birds, wild birds, but birds that need to be rescued. So, but it's outside, you walk on paths and then maybe come to a cage or container, you know, whatever their habitat is of a certain bird. But they also do falcon displays there. And again, it's just a really natural, you know, place to go picnic and hike, but, you know, has this other component of supporting their mission. So that was interesting. For me, a really funny one, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but, you know, when you say the headliners, everyone's heard of fish boils. Mm. I'm kind of a foodie, you know, unique restaurant person, and I've never gone to a fish boil. So to write the book, I had to go to a fish boil.
Wow.
So that was fun to go and participate in that. We went together to the Clearing Folk School, which was established by Jens Jensen, he's a turn of the century, landscape architect out of Chicago and he's pretty famous in the Chicago area. And it ended up in Door County and established this folk school where you live on the campus and you live with your fellow learners, and it's humanities and art, and it's just in this amazingly beautiful setting. So that was I'd heard of it, never been there. It was a very interesting thing to go and explore it and learn about it and see what classes they offer and how people who choose to stay there to take a class, you know, live communally and everything. So that was kind of interesting. Those are some examples.
The last time my wife and I visited Door County, which was two or three summers ago, that was the occasion of our first visit to the Clearing, which is a place that my father had frequently visited and talked about so lovingly, and it had just never ever worked out for us to take the time to do it. And rather by accident, it just happened that our route took us right past the entrance, and so we drove on in. It was a day without a cloud in the sky, and it was like a little bit of heaven on earth. It was absolutely amazing, and we were so grateful for the opportunity to see it. And I guess that's part of maybe why it's possible to frequently visit Door County and yet never see certain things, because it's not like the place is laid out with a clear grid. I mean, it is by its very nature a place that's going to have sort of cracks and crevices and obscure little corners, and there's all kinds of things that in a sense can be hidden in plain sight or really, really close by, and yet if you don't know about them and seek them out, you're not going to just stumble upon them.
Right, I agree. A favorite of mine I had done before, so I knew about it, but my son and I had attended some plays at the Shakespeare Theater, and that's one of those places that you might pass a sign for it on your way into Bailey's Harbor, but it's hidden way back in the woods, and it's really such a spectacular event, a thing to attend. They do a really neat job, and it's a neat theater setup, and you know, a lot of people go up there year after year and have never ever gone to the Shakespeare Theater. Mm. You know, and it's just a great experience, and you know, it's fun to tell someone that no, this is fun, and you know, it's really worth the time and the cost of admission to attend one of these shows. Mm. You know, so there are, and there's hidden gems all over the place up there.
Right. Let's stay with theater for just a second, because I was really happy to see that your section devoted to music and entertainment actually opened with a place called Northern Sky Theater. And I knew the name. I've never been there, but I knew the name because the local community theater where I am active, where I actually direct many of the musicals and so on, we have done several shows that originated at the Northern Sky Theater. I mean, that had their world premiere at the Northern Sky. So if local listeners remember a show we did a couple of years back called Guys on Ice, that was crafted by somebody on the staff at Northern Sky Theater, and a really goofy little summer musical called Packer Fans from Outer Space, that also emanated from the Northern Sky Theater. Tell our listeners just a little bit more about this particular theater and the kind of things that they offer and why it might be really worth seeking out.
Yeah, the Northern Sky Theater, I don't have a strong understanding of the staff and how all that works, but it's run by local people, very dedicated to it, and I believe they write the shows, like you say, and craft their own shows. But it's a folklore, it used to be called Folklore Theater, and then it changed the name, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. But they do folklore-type things where they're always kind of lovingly and gently poking fun of northern Wisconsin and, you know, different demographics within the Door County region, and then kind of Wisconsin as a whole, or maybe the Midwest. But they always have a theme like that. Like the most recent one I saw, they were sort of poking fun at the sort of farming community out of Brussels, which is a little in the south of Door County. And they had this big bowling scene that was really fun, and their little musicals, like you pointed out. But what's really special about it too is they now have two theaters, but their primary theater for years is an amphitheater within Peninsula State Park. So you have to drive into the park. It's in the woods. You park and walk through the woods, and it's just a really pretty setting. So it's so fun to be out in the park with this, and it's a nice stage. It's a pretty substantial stage, you know, and have this folklore musical. They've recently built a really lovely new building a little bit north on Highway A towards Sister Bay. And so they can run shows. I don't know that they run them all year, but they can run deeper into the year so that it's not so seasonal. And they can run, they run other types of shows up there as well. And then that also gave them a headquarters, you know, for their administration and all that. And it's a real pretty theater that they can open. They have big, it's all made, trimmed in like reclaimed barn wood, and then they can open doors so it can have an outdoor feel but still be an inside theater. Yeah, they do a great job. That's a must see.
Well, there's all kinds of theater that one can experience in Door County, and music as well, and this section of the book is just brimming with one great possibility after another. One thing that came as a surprise to me in this section of the book was something I don't remember encountering. I know I've never visited it or seen it, and I feel like I've never even heard of it, but it sounds so wonderful. Plum Loco Animal Farm. Tell our listeners about this.
So Plum Loco, it's an animal farm where, you know, kids can come and pet animals and feed baby goats and, you know, the good petting zoo thing, but they're committed to, I wouldn't call them a rescue, but, you know, taking care of the working animals that you would see on a farm, and they're very environmentally conscious. And, you know, so there's a lot of learning there about the farm life and the animals while you're still surrounded by all that cuteness, you know. So it's a great place for little kids to, you know, have fun, but also, you know, maybe learn a little something while they're there. So
right.
I'm doing a book signing there in 2 weeks.
Very good. In the section that is devoted to exploring nature and recreation, you of course talk about things like hiking trails and all of the beautiful parks and so on. One of the parks that is specifically mentioned, Newport State Park in Ellison Bay, has a very special distinction. It is a dark sky park. And again, this is one of those things where I'm embarrassed to have not ever even heard of this particular terminology. Explain what a dark sky park is and what it means when a park is given this special designation.
Yeah, that, you know, this is one of those things that a lot of people don't know about, and it's a pretty big deal. So there's certain requirements to be an officially designated dark sky park. And, you know, basically a lot of it is your proximity from any kind of light pollution. So basically you get a really, you know, dark, crazy, robust, starry sky at night. And I don't have my book with me with the stats, but I believe it says there's like 20 dark sky parks in our country, something like that, and 50 on the whole planet. So, you know, to have this park be a dark sky park is a pretty substantial piece of credibility, you know, for the, and then you can go, and I haven't done it yet, and I really want to do it, but you can go, and there's places they recommend, or you can go on the beach and just hang out there and absorb the dark sky, or take your telescope, and, you know, weather permitting, of course, you have to have clear, but, you know, but it's one of those, this where the sky is so spectacular, like what you see looking through a telescope and not what we would normally see at night here in our cities with all the light pollution.
Right. Fascinating. I think it's the very next page that makes reference to something that also I was not aware existed. Well, I certainly was quite aware of all of the shipwrecks that, of course, are part of the Great Lakes. But I did not realize that there was such a thing as a kayak shipwreck tour. Can you tell us anything about that? I'm very, very intrigued.
Yeah, so there are some shipwrecks in some of the more shallow parts of on the Lake Michigan side outside of Bailey's Harbor. So some of the kayak companies do take tours if the lake is calm enough that you can go out in a kayak, and from your kayak, it's shallow enough that you can see, you know, the shipwreck underneath you. Wow. So that's kind of neat. And there are some tours that take you out in boats to see the shipwrecks. And And of course, there's some shipwrecks that if you're a diver, you can dive to. You can do a diving expedition to a shipwreck as well.
Wow. I want to give you a chance to respond to what is, I think, a frequent assumption made, and there's probably more than a grain of truth in it, and that when it comes to the matter of, particularly of eating and drinking, eating out in Door County, that it is an expensive place to be. That by and large, we are talking about places where you need to be prepared to spend a substantial amount of money to have a good meal anywhere in Door County. I wonder to what extent that is a fair statement, and if you have any advice for people where that might be a bit of a concern.
So I would, anyone who thinks that, I would respectfully disagree with that. So just like any place, there's a range. If you go to Chop, that is a steakhouse that's known for its steaks, be ready to drop $35 to $50 for that steak. But there's plenty of places that have good food that, you know, it's in line with everywhere else around. And there's also a lot of really fun just bars and grills and pizza places and things. So when you're there with the kids, you can find plenty to eat that makes them happy that you're not, you know, having to mortgage your house to pay for it. So I think there's a little bit of everything, but there are some high-end restaurants. And of course, there's a lot of seafood, and seafood can tend to be more expensive. So it just depends on what you pick. Just do your research.
Right. A last quick question. This really impressed me a lot. This would be an example of one of the 100 things where there's more than one. And so this is where we actually get more than 100 things in Door County. And that is where you talk about the beaches. And you and your co-author, I think, do a really good thing for the reader, a helpful thing for the reader, in sharing about different kinds of beaches and sort of acknowledging the fact that different people might be looking for very different beach experiences. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so, first of all, with the amount of shoreline that there is in Door County, there are a lot of beaches. And each town has a couple of public beaches within the town. And there's probably one of the more famous beaches is at Whitefish Dunes State Park, and it's real sandy. But what you're referring to is that we sort of categorize the beaches because if your idea of sitting on a beach is being really, you know, having a Zen experience and taking your book, I mean, you can find a really remote beach on Washington Island or in Newport State Park that you can just be away from other humans. You know, if you want a white, sandy, traditional, looks like California beach, you know, you're going to want to be in like Whitefish Dunes State Park or something like that. If you want a beach where you can play and then you can walk into town and grab a beer, you're going to want to be at the beach in Sister Bay, you know. And if you've got little kids that just want to build sandcastles and splash in the water, you're going to want to know which beaches are a little more shallow and have nicer sandy bottoms and that sort of thing. So we try to divide them into categories like that to guide you for what you might be looking for your vacation.
So a beach is not a beach is not a beach. I mean, they come in different varieties.
Everybody.
Yeah, a beach for everybody. I like that very much. I think the risk with writing a book like this, any kind of guidebook, if you will, is that things come and go. And particularly, of course, in the wake of COVID, there are all kinds of various establishments that were not able to survive that grim period. I mean, for instance, you know, I was shocked when my wife and I visited. We weren't really visiting the Wisconsin Dells. We were just eating there on our way home. But we were shocked at how many restaurants were boarded up and other tourist businesses in the Wisconsin Dells, at least at that point in time, were completely shut down. It was sad, and we hope there's been a bit of rebound there. By and large, how did Door County do in terms of enduring COVID? And did you think very much about this whole matter of things that come and go and open and close? I mean, did you think a lot about trying to craft a book that would have lasting value and relevancy?
Yes, we did, because I had that experience with the Rockford book. It came out in 2019, and then COVID hit. And Rockford, surprisingly, did pretty well in the immediate aftermath of COVID in terms of what I had in my book. But, you know, over time, I mean, cities and places like Door County, I consider them sort of like living, breathing organisms. You know, they never stand still. They don't stand still. What you do is you do try to think through, if there's a restaurant that is too new and you think it's maybe a little too trendy to a certain group, maybe you don't want to put it in the book, even though you'd like them to have the exposure. You know, restaurants are the worst. They come and go. But it's just the risk of this type of book. In fact, we had one. There was a neat German restaurant called Hugelhaus that we really liked, and they did an Oktoberfest, and it had this neat interior that was sort of a mid-century meets a German hunting lodge, and I had a neat entry written about it and kind of making fun of all the worst. It was like, have your worst meal at Hugelhaus because of all the bratwursts and knackwursts and all that. And right before we went to press, we learned they closed. So we had to quickly pull it out and do some shuffling. So it you can't prevent that. But yeah, you can do your best to try to think what has staying power and, you know, try to focus on that. So.
Well, I must say, I read this book with great interest and was not disappointed. I so appreciated all of the information that is gathered there, and also the fun, breezy, informal tone that the book takes. And so it is a fun read. And in some ways, even if you are not anticipating a visit to Door County in the near future, it's still a fun read because you're just reminded of this truly remarkable place, unlike anything else, and all that there is in Door County for one to enjoy. And so I commend you and your co-author, Gene O'Brien Gibbons, on this really lovely book, 100 Things to Do in Door County Before You Die, published by Reedy Press. Tamara Goman, thank you so much, and thank you for being my morning show guest.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from the Morning Show archive. And we spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with one of the most gifted and capable writers when it comes to young readers, Valerie Tripp, probably best known for all the work that she has done on the American Girl series. But here on The Morning Show to talk about an exciting new adventure for her in collaboration with National Geographic, a new series called Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad. And Valerie Tripp, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me here today.
Right. A couple of overarching questions, and then we'll get to Izzy Newton in a moment. I read in your biography that you were a philosophy major in college. I wonder if you can trace the line from being a philosophy major to the kind of writing that you have done in your very successful career.
Greg, I love you for asking that question because, you know, when I told my parents I was going to be a philosophy major, I remember my dear father saying, well, are you going to get a job as a philosopher? I don't think they have jobs for philosophers. But here's what it was, Greg. I had to translate the philosophies that I read were so complicated. I had to translate them for myself into very simple, direct, and clear language in order to remember them. And both in the case of writing for American Girl, where I was taking complicated history concepts and economic or social and political concepts, and, if you will, translating them and stating them in the clearest most direct form for my readers who were, you know, 8 to 10 years old. The philosophy stood me in very good stead. The practice that I had stood me in very good stead. And now, writing this STEM-based series for National Geographic Kids, it's the same thing. I'll take a very complicated scientific concept and say, okay, we have to make this not only clear, so my reader who's 8 to 12 years old will understand it, but I have to make it matter to my reader as well. Because when you have an emotional connection, that's when you remember something that you have read. So to tell you the truth, that background in philosophy and reading very complicated things and trying to state them clearly and simply turned out to be, surprisingly, an excellent background for exactly what I do, writing for children.
Thank you
so much for asking that. No one's ever asked me about that before.
I'm glad I asked. I also want to ask you about the fact that you also write for reading textbooks. And that connection, of course, is much clearer. But I suspect that there are connections even beyond the obvious in terms of writing for reading textbooks and then writing books that young people read.
Yes, it helps me very much to be aware of, for example, the reading level that is appropriate for a child, so in terms of vocabulary or concept difficulty, because you don't want to insult your reader. I have a lot of respect for my readers. I don't want to insult my reader by having it be simplistic, and I want it to really resonate with the reader of exactly the age group that I'm writing for. They are my inspiration. My readers are my inspiration. Quite literally, that's where my ideas come from speaking to my readers whenever I have a chance to do so. And I want to be sure that I'm writing at the level that will interest and engage and absorb and stretch them just a tad, you know, just a little, stretch you just a little bit.
Was it National Geographic who came to you with a very specific invitation, or did this collaboration begin in a little more sort of open-ended fashion and then eventually take the shape that it has with Izzy Newton?
Okay, well, here's the truth. A friend whom I adore, who's a librarian at a school, called me and said, oh, Valerie, my speaker for tomorrow, you know, can't come. Could you possibly come and just speak as a substitute, last-minute substitute? So I said, sure, because I love Carolyn. And that's where I met Rebecca Baines, who was the head of children's publishing at National Geographic Kids. And she said, would you ever be interested in writing a fiction series? And I said, are you kidding? It would be a dream come true. I would love to do that. So National Geographic, Becky already had the idea for the series in mind, and she had already come up with this really fun idea of having the titles be plays on words. The first book's Absolute Hero, which is a play on Absolute Zero, and the mystery is about why the school is so freezing cold, and also there's a mystery about why there's a chilliness in one of the friendships. So National Geographic Kids already had the structure of the series, and when they came to me, I said, oh, I would love to do this, and it has been a pure pleasure to work with National Geographic Kids.
I think a lot of us who don't know anything about the business of writing for young readers assume that the most important thing is choosing the words. I mean, that the words not be too complicated or not too long or whatever, or the sentences not too long. But I'm sure there is more to it, especially when you've crafted this book, Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad. What kinds of things did you think about in terms of the way these stories should be shaped and crafted? I mean, the storyline, what is the key to connecting with readers of this age?
Well, the first and most important thing, as I said, was that I want my readers to become friends with these characters so that they will care about what's going on with them. And I wanted sort of the through thread of all of the stories to be about kindness and about functioning as a group and respecting differences in a group. These are five very diverse girls, and sort of metaphorically, the fact that they're interested in the different fields of science shows you that they really come at the world in very different directions, and they learn to respect those differences and solve the mysteries by pooling those various talents, and really they benefit by how their differences. That was a very important point that I wanted to make. I also wanted to make a point about failures, that failure is a good thing. As a writer, I have to write my stories four or five times before I get them right. And scientists, and certainly my five characters, their experiments fail constantly. And you can learn a lot from a failure. So I try to start with an emotional kind of start, heart and soul first, and then go to the brain and cerebral part. I try to engage them and know what really matters to my readers of this age. I was so helped by the fact that one of the ways I did my research was by having lunch with a bunch of girls. We called ourselves the Lunch Bunch, and I would bring cookies, and they would tell me what was going on with them in school and facing the challenges of middle school and the way middle school is different from elementary school and the challenges of being 10 going on 11 and 12 and how your life is different. Things are a little more complicated now. And that group of girls gave the stories such authenticity. I couldn't have manufactured that. You can't sprinkle authenticity on afterward. It has to be organic. The story has to be nourished by the realism and the stories that these real girls told me about what was mattering to them. I'm just endlessly grateful to them because they were the heart and soul, really, of these stories.
A last quick question. This book and the whole series is labeled as STEM-based, and certainly science is a very strong ingredient. Is that something that is of a personal interest to you, or is that a little bit of a stretch for you to be writing a book in which the sciences are such an important element?
Well, I always loved science. I especially loved physics when I was in school. But one of the points that I wanted to make was science doesn't only happen in a lab. We're all part of a living science experiment, are we not? That we've learned how important it is to wash our hands and wear masks. We're learning about engineers reconfiguring our public spaces to keep us safe. I want to say to girls, when you care for your pet, when you are careful and not wasting water and you're protecting the environment, when you're designing something, when you're doing digital art, that's STEM. It's not some arcane thing that's just tucked away on a shelf somewhere. You're a scientist already. You're living science every single day. All of us are. So we have to just, you know, sort of blow the dust off any kind of stereotype about what science is or what girls do or what boys do, or that if I want to say to my readers, if you're interested in this, if this is your passion, don't you let anyone talk you out of it.
From National Geographic, Izzy Newton and the Smart Squad, the first book titled Absolute Hero, Valerie Tripp, the author. Valerie Tripp, thank you so much. Best wishes, and keep on writing.
Thank you very much, Greg. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Bye-bye. We will spend most of tomorrow's morning show talking with Rob Cruz, who is both stage director and music director for the next production at the Racine Theater Guild, the delightful musical Drowsy Chaperone. The production opens this coming weekend. Then on Friday, out of the archives, a conversation I recorded a few years ago with writer S.E. Hinton, author of The Outsiders, one of the most popular novels for young readers ever published, and now transformed into an award-winning Broadway musical. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The Morning Show archive is on our website, wgtd.org. And I'm happy to say that the Morning Show podcast seems to be up and running once again. To enjoy a different Morning Show 7 days a week, seek out the Morning Show podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Our weather forecast calls for partly cloudy skies today and a 40% chance for strong to severe thunderstorms developing over the afternoon. Our high temperature today, 89, and a heat index near 97. Cloudy skies tonight, a substantial chance for showers or thunderstorms, overnight low of 66. Lingering clouds tomorrow, but much more mild with a high of 73. Beautiful on Friday with mostly sunny skies and a high of 76 degrees. Right now it looks like a 50% chance of rain on Saturday as we warm into the low 80s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and